Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Emergency and Critical Care Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognised specialist in veterinary small animal medicine, Yvonne McGrotty. Thank you, Yvonne. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you for the introduction, Emer, and welcome to everyone listening today. I'd like to apologise in advance in case you can hear my overweight and brachycephalic dogs snoring in the background, but just be grateful you can't smell them. So please feel free to write your Q&A questions. I'll try and answer them at the end. But without further ado, let's move forward and talk a little bit about tube feeding. So when we think of tube feeding, we obviously have to ask ourselves the question, when do we start feeding patients? And as a general rule, any patient that's been anorexic for longer than 48 hours would be a candidate for some form of assisted feeding. Inadequate food intake in small animal practice is a very common sign, and in fact, most animals will have been anorexic for at least 24 to 48 hours by the time they present for veterinary attention, so many of our patients will fulfil this criteria from the outset, from the very first point of contact. After about 2 to 3 days of anorexia, the body will shift from anabolic to catabolic metabolism. And the consequences of malnutrition are really very serious and will include lowered immunocompetence and decreased wound healing. So other reasons why you might want to start feeding a patient earlier other than just anorexia or hyperexia for a period of time would be weight loss that cannot be controlled, significant hypoalbuminemia, which in itself is an indicator of chronic negative nitrogen balance, or if there's some trauma or surgery that's anticipated, which is going to lead to the patient being unable to have a reasonable food intake for more than 2 to 3 days. So that may include some form of facial surgery or any patient that's experienced any form of facial trauma. So malnourished patients are much greater risk of morbidity and mortality, and failure to address that at an early stage will increase the risk of complications later on in the course of the animal's illness, regardless of what has caused it to begin with. So what can we do? Well, as the saying goes, if the gut works, then use it. And this is very, very true. If the animal can take oral feeding, then you should encourage that. But it's really only applicable if the animal can consume at least 85% of its resting energy requirements over the course of the day. If it's only managing 20-25%, then obviously it's going to go into a catabolic state. And even though it's managing to eat something, it's not going to be sufficient, and some form of assisted feeding is going to be required. Parenteral feeding is another option, but it has a lot more complications associated with it than enteral feeding. And it's something that we only use when really we've exhausted other possibilities. Enteral nutrition is much safer, is much cheaper, and it's certainly more convenient. In one study they did in North America, they looked at some referral hospitals and looked at whether the patients in that hospital were having an adequate nutritional balance throughout the course of their hospitalisation, and they were able to prove that 2/3 of hospitalised animals have negative nitrogen balance just purely due to poor management. So mainly just from the vets in charge of the case not paying attention to the nutritional requirements of that patient and focusing perhaps too much on the other abnormalities that the animal has. So that's some food for thought, if you pardon the pun. So for the purposes of today, we're going to talk primarily about tube feeding, and there are 4 different ways that this can be performed. The first is nasoesophageal tube feeding, second is esophagostomy, third gastrostomy, and finally jejunostomy tube. We're not going to discuss jejunostomy tubes in any detail here because they require some surgical technique to put them in and have a greater risk of complications and are just more tricky in general. So I think it's less likely that any of you will be using them in general practice. The very first point you need to consider is, will the patient tolerate the placement of the tube, which in some instances might require an anaesthetic or sedation, and will it tolerate feeding via that tube? And obviously, if the answer is no, then we need to seek other alternatives. But hopefully, if you're able to place tubes, we can address their nutritional imbalances pretty quickly. So let's talk first about nasoesophageal tubes. And you'll notice that I am using the term nasoesophageal rather than nasogastric. These tubes should not enter the stomach. If it passes through the lower esophageal sphincter into the stomach, it can cause irritation and increase the chance of reflux. So these tubes are designed to sit in the distal esophagus, not in the stomach. Now, the problem with these tubes is that they are generally very narrow bore. So for a cat, we'd be anticipating use of either a 3.5 to 5 French tube. In medium to larger dogs, maybe about a 6 French and above. So still very, very narrow. And as a result of that, really only liquid diets can be utilised. They're generally quite poorly tolerated as well. And they can only be used short term while the animal is in hospital. One positive aspect to these tubes is that they can be placed in the conscious patient. So it don't always require even sedation, just a little bit of local anaesthetic in the nostril, which we'll cover in a second, and it can be placed in the conscious patient. But I just want to draw your attention to the fact that this little picture on the right-hand side here shows you exactly how you shouldn't place a feeding tube, a nasoesophageal feeding tube, in a cat or a dog. As you can see here, the nasoesophageal tube is coming out of the right nostril, and the person who has placed this has then stuck a little butterfly tape over the whiskers, which will really irritate the patient. Also, it's flapping in front of the eye here, which will be very irritating and make the animal want to try and remove that. And then it's been brought up round and over the back of the head. So this is an example of how not to place a nasoesophageal tube. If you're going to place one, they have to come up between the eyes to try and prevent irritation, either through the animal being able to see the tube or feeling it touching its whiskers. But for me personally, I use nasoesophageal tubes really very infrequently, because I just feel that their disadvantages in most cases outweigh their advantages. But if you are using them, there are some indications to consider. Really, as I mentioned in previous slides, short-term feeding is all that's appropriate. So we're talking a few days here, and the animal does need to remain hospitalised for that period of time. Contraindications include any form of facial or nasal disease, so any form of nasal or facial trauma, or tumours, for example, would prevent placement. If the animal has esophageal disease, such as a stricture or severe esophagitis, that would be contraindicated, as the tube will irritate the lining of the esophagus. And if the patient has intractable vomiting, that would also be a contraindication, because of the high likelihood of the tube being vomited up into the oral cavity, or worse still, being vomited and then entering the trachea, with a higher risk of aspiration occurring. So how do you place a nasoesophageal tube? Well, it can be placed in the conscious patient, or you can use a very light sedative. You kind of want them conscious so that they've got the swallowing reflex intact, so you don't really want to be placing these in heavily sedated or anaesthetised patients. You instill local anaesthetic into one of the nostrils, and for that you can use either Intubees or 0.5% proximeticaine. Give that a few moments to work, preferably holding the head upwards so that the local anaesthetic will dribble down the nasal passages and give some kind of anaesthetic relief to the ventral meatus, which is where the tube will be going. You then want to measure your nasoesophageal tube from the nostril to the 8th intercostal space, and mark this point on the tube either using a permanent marker or some piece of tape or some way of ensuring you know where that point lies. Lubricate the end of the tube. This can be done just using sterile KY jelly or any other form of sterile lubricating jelly. Or you can even use a gel that's got some local anaesthetic in it. But remember to go easy with local anaesthetic in cats, because they don't tolerate it well at all. You then insert the lubricated tube into the ventral nasal meatus, directing it ventromedially, so downwards and towards the opposite eye. We're aiming to get this into the ventral meatus. As it passes towards the back of the throat, the cat should be encouraged to swallow, and that will facilitate passage into the esophagus. You then advance the tube to the predetermined mark and secure the tube between the eyes with either sutures, glue, or even staples. You then want to ensure the tube position is correct using radiography. And at that stage, assuming it is in the correct place, the tube is ready to use. But there are complications you need to be aware of. The first one is tube blockage, and that's very common in nasoesophageal tubes because they're such narrow bore tubes that anything other than a complete liquid diet can have a high risk of tube obstruction. The tube can migrate back up the esophagus and perhaps into the lungs or into the oropharynx with a high risk of aspiration pneumonia developing, particularly if the animal is being sick. One of the biggest complications, however, and most spectacular if it goes wrong, would be inadvertent placement of the tube into the lungs. And obviously we will do our utmost to make sure that doesn't happen and to ensure we're happy with the placement of the tube prior to its use. So we'll cover that in a moment. And lastly, epistaxis. Now, the picture on the right is probably a little bit extreme for a placement of a nasoesophageal tube, but if the animal has any nasal disease or if it has low platelet counts, then any trauma to the nasal passages can lead to epistaxis, and that can be quite distressing for the pet, client and vet alike. So how do we confirm the correct placement of the tube? Well, the first and easiest that requires the least apparatus is just applying suction to the tube using an empty 5 or 10 ml syringe. Because the esophagus is muscular, negative pressure should be present when you aspirate back as the wall of the esophagus collapses around the end of the tube. So if you're aspirating and getting air back, that would be a big warning bell that perhaps you're in the wrong area and the tube should be replaced. An alternative, or you could do it after you've performed aspiration, is to instill 5 to 10 mils of air into the tube and listen over the cranial abdomen for borborygmi. And you can also instill about 3 to 5 mils of saline into the tube and just check for coughing. Now, just be aware that coughing doesn't always occur if you put saline into the trachea or airways. So failure to cough doesn't absolutely suggest that it's in the correct place, but it is an indication, and certainly if coughing did occur, then you wouldn't use that tube for feeding. And lastly, and possibly least utilised, is attaching a capnograph. Now, the esophagus will not produce any form of CO2, so if you attach a capnograph and you're getting a CO2 trace on your capnograph, then that tells us that tube is misplaced and must not be used. So that's us briefly covered nasoesophageal tubes, which I'm not a huge fan of. However, what I do like are esophagostomy tubes, and they are actually pretty easy to place and very easy to maintain. So even if you haven't attempted esophagostomy tubes before, I would urge you to consider using them in the future, and hopefully this little overview will give you confidence to do that. So esophagostomy tubes are much wider bore than those we would have used as nasoesophageal feeding tubes. In cats, we can use 10 to 14 French, and in dogs, upwards of that, usually 14 to 24 French. And they come a variety of lengths. In cats, usually about 23 centimetres, and in dogs, about 40 centimetres. These are great. They can be long-term, so we can leave these in for a number of weeks or months, and the animal can go home with the tube in situ, which allows the owner to participate in the care of the patient and reduce hospitalisation fees. These are the ones I particularly like here, but there are other ones available. They're nice and soft and pliable, and they have radiopaque markers in them, which makes them much easier to identify on radiographs further down the line. The fact that these tubes are a much wider bore than nasoesophageal tubes allows us to pretty much use any diet via these tubes. Any diet can be liquidised and blended and put via this tube, which means we can fulfil other nutritional requirements. For example, if the animal has pancreatitis, we can use a low-fat diet. If the animal has kidney disease, we can use a kidney-specific diet, which we would be unable to use for nasoesophageal tube feeding, because the volume of water we would need to add to a diet to get it down that tube would be quite considerable, and we probably wouldn't be able to achieve full maintenance as far as calories are concerned with the narrow bore tube. So these esophagostomy tubes are excellent. There are a few contraindications you need to consider first. If the animal has intractable vomiting, then it's likely that that ongoing vomiting will cause the tube to be dislodged very soon after placement. So unless you can control the vomiting prior to placement, you may need to reconsider this as an option. The same as for NO tubes, esophageal disease would be a contraindication, whether that be stricture or tumour or severe inflammation. But I would also urge caution in using these tubes in comatose or recumbent patients. As you can imagine, we need that swallowing reflex and we need the animal to be able to respond in case fluid or food does go the wrong way and end up in the lungs. So if you've got a comatose or recumbent patient, it's not going to have those reflexes to the same extent, and there's a much higher risk of aspiration. Also, because the placement of an esophagostomy tube does require an anaesthetic, we need to consider patients' anaesthetic risks, and if the risks are too high, then we may need to consider other options. But esophagostomy tubes are really very easy to place. Even a simple medic can place these, a medic that's usually afraid of dealing with scalpels at any other stage. And we've got a few pictures and a little video later down the line to show you how this is done. Now, the patient does need a general anaesthesia, but usually the anaesthetic and placement takes about 10 minutes, so it's not a prolonged procedure in any way, shape, or form. The animal needs to be placed in right lateral recumbency. So in this picture here, in case it's not clear, the head is up here and this is the angle of the shoulder here. The area from the angle of the jaw to the shoulder is then clipped and aseptically prepared. You can use a fenestrated drape. In some cases, I find it makes the identifying certain landmarks more complicated, but it certainly keeps the procedure much more aseptic. But you do need to shave and aseptically prepare this fairly large area to begin with. You then need to identify where the tube is going to be placed. And for this, the first thing you do is identify where the jugular vein is sitting. Now, in this extremely skinny and somewhat scruffy cat, it's very obvious where the jugular is running. I've actually got one of my assistants here pressing in the jugular furrow to raise that vein so that it's very obvious. So clearly we want to avoid that. So when we're placing the tube, make yourself familiar with where the jugular is lying and avoid placing in that region. So we then place some curved hemostats into the mouth. So your assistant will be doing this. The curved hemostats go into the mouth, down into the mid esophagus, and they then push the tips laterally so that they poke up via the skin. You can see them here on the picture at the bottom. This is then your landmark for insertion of your tube. So your assistant maintains that position with these the tips of the curved hemostats poking up through the skin. Next, you then want to make a 5 to 10 millimeter incision, using probably either 15 or 20 scalpel blade, and you incise over the pointed tips of the forceps. And you want to incise right the way down so that the tip of the forceps sticks out through the hole, as shown in the bottom photograph here. At this stage, your assistant, who's still got the forceps in position, will then push the forceps through the incision a little bit further and open the jaws as shown. At this point, you then want to gather your esophagostomy tube and measure the distance from the point of insertion where the hole in the esophagus now is showing in the neck, and measure from there to the seventh intercostal space and mark the point on the tube with either a permanent marker or a piece of tape. At this stage, you then grab the distal end of the tube, which is with the forceps. So the forceps are used to grab the distal tip, and your assistant then pulls the tube through the incision, through the esophagus, and up via the mouth so that they can grasp it at the other side. At that stage, the assistant then has to curl the distal tip around so that it's pointing now back down towards the stomach. It's a good idea to make sure the tip is quite well lubricated at this stage so that it doesn't stick at the back of the throat. Now, if you do this correctly, then at some stage the proximal end of the tube will be seen to flip directions and face rostrally when it's seated the correct way. So what we would be aiming for is for the tube with the cat's head here, we'd aim for the tube to be facing this way with the syringe attachment here and the distal tip of the tube now firmly seated within the esophagus, so the tube will be seated in this direction. You do get a distinct kind of pop when that happens, which can be quite satisfying. And what I'm hoping I can show you is that on the video here, which we'll just set up for you, you can see that pop. So just as I begin to start it, you'll see that the tube coming out is facing caudally. And as the assistant, who's towards the left-hand side of the screen, starts to feed the tube back down through the esophagus, the point at which the tube is entering through the neck pops round so that the tube is facing the correct direction. So I'll just show you that just now. So you can see the assistant's just feeding the tube down from the left-hand side via the mouth. And then you see the pop. So see, there was quite a distinctive movement there. I might just show you that one more time so that you can get a feel for how that looks. So the assistant is feeding the tube at the mouth end, and as it starts to slide past the esophagus, it flips around to the correct direction. We now know that that is seated in the correct place, and we should be able to move that tube backwards and forwards easily without any signs of obstruction. Once you have placed the tube, you have to confirm that it is correctly placed. And the best way of doing that is using a lateral thoracic radiograph. It doesn't really matter whether it's left or right, but a lateral thoracic radiograph. And these esophagostomy tubes that I use do have this kind of radiopaque tip, which shows you clearly where the tip is sitting. Now, we want that to be round about the seventh intercostal space. For me, I actually think this particular one could have been doing with being pushed maybe one intercostal space back, but it's quite clear where the tube is placed here, and we're quite happy with that. Also, just have a look at where the tube is lying in the proximal part of the thorax or in the cervical region. The tube should certainly never be lying ventral to the trachea or overlying the trachea. We want to see it cleanly running above it to make sure it's in the correct position. So once you're happy that the tube is in the correct position and has been placed to the correct depth, we then need to make sure that that is secured. The best way of achieving that is with a Chinese finger trap suture or Roman sandal suture, whichever you prefer to call it. I don't really have the opportunity to explain how to do that in detail here with videos, but ultimately all you're doing is tying knots on either side of the tube and wrapping the suture material round to secure it tightly to the tube and to the skin itself. Now, one thing I would advise, however, is be careful when applying your finger trap suture that you don't crush the tube so much with your suture that you actually occlude tube itself. I have seen that done once or twice. Obviously, just removing the sutures then will help, but sometimes these tubes are quite soft, and if you apply excessive pressure when applying your knots, you can actually occlude the lumen of the tube itself. And once this is in place, the tube can be used immediately. There's no need to delay feeding for any length of time. You can just start straight away feeding this patient with a food of your choosing. The area where the tube has been inserted into the neck should be kept clean and dry. So we like to apply a little pad or gauze with maybe some povidone iodine over the insertion point, and then we cover the wound and the tube with some form of padded dressing, as shown in the picture here. We've got a nice padded dressing with the tube just poking out the top. Did want to mention, however, something I've come across fairly recently, and they're known as kitty collars. And I think they're really excellent for cats and some small dogs that have esophagostomy tubes placed. They come in a variety of sizes and colours, and they have a little hole in them, as shown here, which allows the feeding tube to pass through it. And then as the tube comes out, it can also be passed under the Velcro tape, as shown here, which helps keep the tube flat and keep it in position. It's very comfortable for the patient. It comes with a little circular cotton pad which goes round the insertion site and protects the wound, and it often is very well tolerated and prevents patient interference. So although I would say the vast majority of animals are going to need a buster collar to prevent interference, I have noticed that there are a lot of cats that will tolerate the kitty collars and keeping the O-tube in place without the need for a buster collar on top of that. And some of the larger kitty collars can be used in small dogs as well. So what kind of complications might we have with a esophagostomy tube? Well, there's always the potential for cellulitis extending along the neck region. Infection at the insertion site, usually that's hopefully quite mild and can be avoided by regular checking and cleaning of the insertion site. It could also be that the tube becomes dislodged or displaced, and that may be either through vomiting or the patient interfering with the tube. But possibly one of the biggest complications that we, or more common complications that we get, I should say, would be tube blockage. And that is better avoided by good tube management rather than trying to deal with the consequences. But tube blockage can happen in a tube of any size, much more likely in the narrower the tube, but even in a esophagostomy tube, which is wider bore, it may still happen. But all is not lost if it becomes blocked. There are ways around this. One of the best ways you can unblock a tube is by simple application of a fizzy drink. It doesn't need to be any specific brand, but you would apply a few mils of a fizzy drink and let it sit in the tube for maybe 10 to 15 minutes. And after about 10 to 15 minutes, it would be very common for that obstruction to have cleared and for you then to be able to use the tube for feeding as before. If any of you have seen what cola can dissolve, if you place various objects in it, you'll realise why that's the case. So any fizzy drink can be applied via the tube and can help relieve the obstruction. It won't do it straight away. You do need to leave it sitting in the tube for about 10 to 15 minutes to have that effect. But the best way to avoid that, regardless of what tube you're using, is to flush repeatedly. So even if you're not using the tube regularly, which may apply to either esophagostomy tubes or gastrostomy tubes, which we'll come on to in a moment, you need to make sure they're maintained by keeping them flushed with water. Care of an esophagostomy tube is fairly basic. You want to check the insertion site at least once a day and look for any evidence of infection or swelling or pain. You would probably advise that the insertion site is cleaned with either dilute chlorhexidine or povidone iodine about once a day too. So if the animal is going home with the tube in situ, that can be done by the owner at home. At least once a day, the tube is going to completely strip down to look at that insertion point, and so then you would redress it. And each time you do any kind of maintenance with the tube itself should be flushed with between 5 and 10 mils of water. The volume of water you use will be dependent on the size of the animal and the size of the tube. So obviously, 5 mils would probably be more than sufficient for a relatively small old tube in a cat, whereas 10 to 15 mils might be more appropriate in a much larger tube in a larger breed dog. So just to show you again, I've shown you a lot of ways that you can keep the O-tube in place. You can just use simple vet wrap or the equivalent. You can use the kitty collars. Or the other thing I like to use is, for those of you who are a fan of 90s TV shows, what I like to call the Rab C. Nesbitt string vest. So it's these just kind of like tubey grip type bandages, which are very stretchy, and a small piece of that can be used to cover the site of the O-tube and keep it in place and to minimise patient interference. If at any point you decide that the O-tube has served its purpose and you wish to remove it, there is no special technique involved. It can be removed at any time, so that can be from day one or several months later. All you have to do is remove the suture at the insertion point and then gently withdraw the tube out through the hole, and there's no need to close the wound. That wound will heal by second intention. So a very simple process to remove an esophagostomy tube. So let's just go back and look at the comparison between nasoesophageal and esophagostomy tubes. So for nasoesophageal tubes, we don't require anaesthesia, whereas for esophagostomy we do. However, the NO tubes are only suitable for short-term use, whereas the O tubes can be used for weeks or even months. Nasoesophageal tubes will only tolerate a liquid diet, and for O tubes, any diet can be used as long as it's blended. NO tubes are often poorly tolerated because they exit via the nose and over the face, which a lot of animals, particularly cats, don't like, compared to esophagostomy tubes, which are exceptionally well tolerated. And lastly, while an animal has an NO tube in place, you cannot discharge the patient in case of risks of it being dislodged, whereas owners can be taught to use the esophagostomy tube at home. Now, I do cover more about using the tube for feeding in a few slides' time, but I will remind you at this stage, every single time you use either an NO tube or an O tube, you do confirm its correct placement by applying negative pressure on a syringe to ensure that we're not getting air back. That is done every time any fluid or food is applied via that tube to make sure that the animal has not dislodged that tube and it's not now within the airways. So now I want to talk about gastrostomy tubes, which many of you will be less familiar with. There are a couple of options for gastrostomy tubes. The first one is surgical placement, which I'm not going to describe because I'm sure your surgical technique is considerably better than mine. But I will discuss endoscopic placement of a feeding tube. So that's known as a PEG tube or percutaneous entering gastrostomy tube. You can place them blind, so not using an endoscope, but I wouldn't recommend that. There's an increased risk of damaging other abdominal organs. So I would generally recommend that these tubes should be placed with the assistance of an endoscope. So if you don't have an endoscope, probably not something you're going to be able to do. Talking about the complications or contraindications rather first, if the animal has significant gastric disease, then that's not going to appreciate a large tube being poked through it. So gastric disease would be a contraindication. Ascites would also be a contraindication because the volume of fluid will make it much more difficult to get good adhesion between the stomach wall and the peritoneal mucosa and increase the risk of wound breakdown. Hypoalbuminemia would be a contraindication if it's fairly severe because that will reduce the risk of wound healing and therefore increase the risk of dehiscence and possibly peritonitis. And that it also applies to animals that are significantly immunosuppressed. Their wound healing will be compromised, which will put the patient at increased risk of the gastrostomy tube failing and dehiscence of the wound. So there are lots of commercial kits available which make life a lot easier now. I like this one, but there are a few out there. Used to be that you just had a mushroom tip tube and you had to kind of fashion together the rest of the equipment you needed. But this makes life much, much more tolerable. So this little kit here provides everything you need. It's got a needle and guide wire. The guide wire is contained in this little plastic tubing here. It's got the tube itself with its little button tip. And it also comes with the wire to pull it through the abdominal, through the stomach and through the skin, and also a fixation device to adequately attach it to the skin after placement. So these are pretty good. So, first of all, in order to place a PEG tube, you need to induce anaesthesia. So same rules apply. Is the animal fit for an anaesthetic? Is the animal going to tolerate this procedure? You then want to place the patient in right lateral recumbency and clip and aseptically prepare the left flank as shown in the image on the right hand side of your screen. You then will require a minimum of two people in order to perform this procedure. The first is in charge of dealing with the tube exiting the stomach via the body wall, and the other operator is using the endoscope to facilitate placement. So the operator who has the endoscope passes the endoscope into the stomach via the mouth, all the way down to the stomach and insufflates the stomach. At this point, if any of you are familiar with endoscopy, you can usually see the light transilluminated through the skin. So you'll see a kind of red light sticking through the skin at the point where the endoscope is closest. That will help you guide where you're going to place your PEG tube. So the stomach is inflated. You then get your assistant, the one who's dealing with the tube end, so to speak, to poke, effectively poke the body wall near the area where they can see the light shining through the skin. The operator who's dealing with the endoscope at this point looks via the scope so that they can see the finger kind of poking through the wall from within the stomach. And at that stage, they draw the scope back just a fraction so that they can see that area clearly, but they've drawn the scope back enough so that it won't be damaged by any equipment now about to be passed through the stomach wall. Your assistant dealing with the tube then makes a small incision in the skin at that point and passes the needle introducer, which is shown in the image here, like a very, very long and thick needle. They pass that needle in a bold motion through the body wall into the stomach, and the operator using the scope will be able to see that needle using the scope. At that stage, the other operator then feeds the guide wire through this needle so that it's passing into the stomach, and that will be visualized once again by the operator using the scope. At that point, the endoscope operator will then grab the wire using endoscopy forceps and pull that wire out via the mouth so that it can be attached to the PEG tube. Obviously, we need to make sure the other end of the wire doesn't go through the skin so that it's lost. So there'll be one end sticking out through the skin and the other end sticking out through the mouth. So the PEG tube is then securely attached to the wire, and the kits that are available, the commercial kits, make that much more simple than it used to be. Usually it's just by tying a kind of figure of eight in the wire and the tube itself. And then the operator who's dealing with the external aspect of the tube starts to pull the wire gently, dragging the PEG tube through the oral cavity, through the esophagus, down into the stomach. As the tip of the tube starts to come in contact with the stomach wall and the skin, the operator on the external side of the patient will need to possibly make small incisions at the site just to facilitate its passage through skin. But small, steady movements are what's required to bring the tube right the way through the body wall. So once the tube has been pulled through, you then need to make sure that the tube is not being pulled too tight against the stomach wall. So the endoscope operator will then have another look internally to make sure that the mucosa round about the bulb of the PEG tube or the button part of the PEG tube is not excessively blanching the mucosa. If it looks blanched, then a little bit less pressure should be applied. We don't want any restriction of blood flow leading to dehiscence of that site. And once you're confident that the tube is in the correct position, you can then secure your tube by attaching the fixing device which comes with it and suturing that to the body wall at the holes shown on the screen. So a little bit more complicated than an esophagostomy tube, but not by much, and once you've done it once or twice, you'll realize that it's perhaps not as complicated as you first thought. Once it's in position, you then apply a sterile dressing. It is very important not to use the PEG tube for 24 hours, and this is to ensure that a tight seal forms between the stomach and the body wall to reduce the risk of peritonitis. And equally, it's very important that the tube is not removed, either accidentally or deliberately, in the first 7 to 10 days of placement. There's a high risk of peritonitis developing. So even if you decide after day two that you don't need to use that tube anymore, you must leave it in place for a minimum of 7 days before removing it. Complications of a PEG tube include infection at the stomatocyte, also puncture and entrapment of internal organs during placement. That can be reduced by using the scope to make sure that we've got good contact between the skin and the stomach wall, and that the spleen, for example, isn't trapped between them. We can get gastric perforation and peritonitis and pressure necrosis of the stomach wall, or we could get tube obstruction or migration. The problem with PEG tubes is complications often are very serious. So if that tube migrates or we do get gastric perforation, then obviously that will lead to peritonitis, which can have a significant morbidity and mortality. When you choose to remove the PEG tube, there are three options available to you. The first is to just remove the fixation device, and if you've been using a kind of mushroom tipped catheter, you can just pull that through the skin with firm pressure. For ones that aren't mushroom tipped, or like the button tipped catheters I showed you in the previous slides, they're not going to pull through the skin, so you've got a couple of options for those. In large breed dogs, so anything over about 20 kilos, you can cut the tube very close to the skin, and the remaining piece of tube will be passed in the faeces, and you can just ask the owners to look out for that over the next couple of days. Alternatively, in smaller dogs, you may need to go back in with a scope and retrieve the inner compartment of the tube to prevent it causing an intestinal obstruction. So how much can you feed via the tube? The first thing we need to do is to calculate the animal's daily energy requirements, and that's known as resting energy requirements. And we then divide that by the kilocalories of the diet that's chosen per meal. And that will give you how many mils has to be fed over a 24-hour period. At that stage, we'll then divide that volume into about 4 to 6 feeds. On day one, we'll provide about a third of their daily requirements. We'll increase that to 2/3 by day two, and aim to be up to full maintenance by day three. Now, if they've had a very prolonged period of anorexia, that may be too much for them. So we'll talk about refeeding syndrome shortly, but if they've had a very prolonged period of anorexia, possibly getting full maintenance over 5 to 7 days may be more appropriate to avoid refeeding syndrome. Most animals will tolerate about 5 to 10 mils per kilo body weight in volume per feed. That can be built up if necessary, but you always want to start slowly at small volumes and work up. We don't want these animals vomiting the food that you've administered up and potentially risking dislodging the tube in the same instance. So let's go back to how we calculate what is required for feeding. So calculating resting energy requirements can be done by multiplying the body weight in kilos to the power of 0.75 and multiplying that by 70. Now, if you don't have a scientific calculator, a cheat's way of doing that is body weight to the power of 0.75 equates to body weight times body weight times body weight, and then square root, square root. But if most of you have smartphones, you're probably aware that if you change your calculator from portrait to landscape, that will generally change your calculator into a scientific calculator and allow you to perform this calculation. But otherwise, body weight times body weight times body weight, square root, and then multiply that by 70, and that will give you your resting energy requirements in kilocalories. In animals that are between 2 and 30 kilos, there is a kind of linear relationship, so you can use a slightly simpler formula, which is 30 times body weight in kilos plus 70. If you have an obese patient, remember you're calculating the RER for their target weight, not their current weight, so that should be borne in mind. And in case any of you are interested in the application of illness factors, we no longer recommend adding illness factors because of the risk of overfeeding. Usually the animals that are requiring tube feeding, etc., are fairly sedentary and are quite ill, so mostly illness factors aren't required. So how do we feed? We ideally want the animal to be sitting or standing, or at the very least in sternal recumbency with its head up. And this applies to any of the tube feeding that we're using. If you're using either an NO tube or an esophagostomy tube, you want to check the tube placement by applying negative pressure with a syringe and making sure that we get a vacuum created and not air. Once you're happy with the tube being in position, you can then start to feed. But before that, you would then flush the tube with between 5 to 10 mils of lukewarm water. Clearly, if there's any coughing, you don't feed and you reassess whether the tube is in the correct position. It is important to warm the food to body temperature to prevent chilling of the animal if it's come straight from the fridge. So just make sure that it remains either at room temperature or it's warmed gently. We don't want it so cold that it's uncomfortable, or worse still, so hot that it burns the gastric mucosa or the esophageal mucosa. If you can get them to sit or stand, it certainly, in my experience, reduces the risk of aspiration because the head's nice and elevated, and hopefully the animal's swallowing reflex is intact. If you're using a PEG tube, the only difference is that before feeding, you would aspirate the tube first. If in a cat you're getting more than about 10 mils of fluid or the previous feed, or in dogs about 10 to 20% of the previous feed back, then you would need to consider delaying feeding and giving the animal a prokinetic, such as metoclopramide, to try and encourage the gastric emptying. And I wouldn't give any more food at that stage if quite a lot was being aspirated back at the time of the next feed. So how often do we feed? Most animals with feeding tubes will tolerate between 3 to 6 feeds per day. We don't really want to go to any less than that. Less frequent feeds may be poorly tolerated due to volume overload, so we want to space this out. And as you start off, probably starting out with 6 feeds makes most sense. By the time the animal is discharged with an esophagostomy or a PEG tube in place, reducing that to 3 feeds a day may be feasible. But if the animal is not tolerating the higher volume, you will need to drop back and use more frequent feeding. So then we need to consider what to feed. And I have taken this little table on the right here from an article which was in the Veterinary Times a couple of years ago. Very, very useful article. It's from an article called Feeding Tubes, What Follows Placement, by somebody called Julia Hinkins. And she has this lovely little table, which I'm not sure how clearly you'll be able to see on the screen, but it details all the various diets that are likely to be used in veterinary practice. And it shows you how many calories are in each can and how much water has to be added to that food as it is to make it pass through feeding tubes. And it will then give you the final calorific content of that mixture that you've made up. So I personally have this cut out and on the cupboard in the kitchen at work so that it can be easily looked at when we're doing any form of tube feeding. But the diet that you choose needs to be based on the patient's needs. So an animal with kidney disease, for example, will have very different nutritional requirements than an animal that perhaps has pancreatitis. Equally so, an animal with gastrointestinal disease will have different requirements. So the beauty of either an O-tube or a PEG tube is that you can choose an appropriate diet for the patient compared to an NO tube, where only liquid diets are really tolerable, and therefore we're somewhat stuck with the commercial high energy diets that are out there. But we do want the diets to be fairly energy dense, so we have to use less of them, and they should be highly digestible. But almost any canned diet can be fed via an O-tube or a PEG tube with a certain amount of water being added. So your typical recovery diets like AD or Recovery or other manufacturers' equivalent, they are good to begin with. In many cases, they're highly digestible, they're low in fiber, they're high in protein, but they are quite high in fat, so they're not suitable for all cases. If you have an animal with pancreatitis, for example, the high fat content of these recovery diets wouldn't generally be appropriate. But the benefit of these is they don't really require dilution. There's also now on the market some pre-prepared liquid diets, which I have to say I really like. This one here is made by Royal Canin, and it comes in various varieties. There's a renal liquid, there's a low-fat liquid, there's a GI liquid, and a recovery liquid. So it kind of covers all bases, and for starting off, these are worth their weight in gold. It does end up getting a little bit expensive if you're using them long term, but to start off with, for speed and for making life as simple as possible, these can be very, very easy to use and very beneficial because it's a ready-made liquid diet pre-prepared for animals with specific conditions. I meant to say in the last slide, I'll just pop back. If you're considering using the human liquid diets, I would advise against that. Most of them lack the essential amino acids that some of our species will require, particularly in cats, and also many of them have cocoa in them, so they'll be a source of methylxanthines, which can be toxic to dogs. So we really shouldn't be using human liquid diets for tube feeding in our patients. Complications of tube feeding. Overfeeding is a definite possibility, and generally we'll see signs of the patient vomiting or having diarrhea or signs of abdominal discomfort. We're trying to get these animals out of the hospital and better, so overfeeding is just going to be contributing to the unpleasant clinical signs that they may be experiencing. So by reducing the amount of volume we're giving them may prevent that from happening. But there is one very significant complication of tube feeding that you should be aware of, and it's called refeeding syndrome. Now, in refeeding syndrome, we get a variety of electrolyte abnormalities. And if you consider the dog on the right-hand side of the screen here, hopefully you can see that he is severely malnourished, emaciated. He is skin and bone. Now, in a case like this, it's quite clear this dog hasn't been fed or fed properly for probably many weeks, not even just a couple of days. Now, when an animal experiences malnourishment, they end up with total body stores of glucose, magnesium, phosphate and potassium being depleted. When they are then fed, particularly if they're fed a carbohydrate-rich diet, that stimulates release of insulin. And that insulin will then lead to increased cellular uptake of phosphate and some other electrolytes, and that will make the depletion, the blood depletion, even worse. So in these instances, the electrolyte abnormalities that we tend to see include hypokalemia, hypophosphatemia, and hypomagnesemia, and that can also be combined with thiamine deficiency. And these have very serious and potentially life-threatening complications. So these are changes that we should be looking out for and predicting. And hypophosphatemia is usually kind of the hallmark finding, so that's the one we tend to see and worry about most potentially. Refeeding syndrome may be more common in cats, but the clinical signs are a result of these electrolyte changes. So the hypophosphatemia can lead to hemolytic anemia, and that hemolytic anemia can then lead to death. Other changes that you will see will relate to either low potassium levels, which can cause extreme weakness, which can also affect the heart, and cardiac disturbances, and neurological signs, which can be associated with the thiamine deficiency. So these changes really are potentially fatal and should be anticipated and avoided at all cost. This is certainly a situation where prevention is much better than cure. When you get refeeding syndrome, it tends to occur within the first 2 to 5 days of feeding. So you should be measuring these parameters regularly throughout that time. And here on the right side of your image, we have a dog that had a feeding tube placed, but perhaps we were a little bit quick with what was going in. We've got an animal that then developed an anemia. And when we applied special stains, we were able to see that this animal had Heinz body anemia, and it was hemolyzing its own red cells due to hypophosphatemia. So that is something that can be very difficult to control, and prevention much better than cure. So how can we avoid that? Well, the best way to avoid it is by starting off incredibly slowly with the amount of calories you're providing the patient with. So although in previous slides we mentioned that we want to start with about a third of the daily requirements on day one, moving up to two-thirds on day two, and then full maintenance on day three. For animals with very prolonged anorexia or malnourishment, we should go much more slowly than that. So in these animals with high risk, we provide no more than about 20% of their resting energy requirements on the first day, and gradually step that up over the next 6 or 7 days to reach full maintenance. That should hopefully offset the chances of refeeding syndrome occurring. In addition, in patients that have high risk, we may want to go with empirical supplementation of some of these electrolytes. So we may supplement potassium, phosphate, magnesium, and thiamine and other B vitamins. We would only do that if we had a baseline measurement of those electrolytes showing that they weren't increased to begin with. Obviously, if they were increased, then adding more in wouldn't be wise. So if they're within reference range or below, you can start empirical supplementation. And there are a variety of products out there that you can use. I'm sure you're all very familiar with supplementing potassium as potassium chloride, but you may be less familiar with supplementing potassium. So there is a preparation out there which is known as Adifos, which is potassium phosphate. And a kind of easy way to supplement phosphate, because this also contains potassium, is to work out how much potassium you want to administer to that patient, and then to give 50% of that volume as potassium chloride and 50% as potassium phosphate. And that way you will be providing both potassium and phosphate at approximately the right levels. Otherwise, there are formulas you can use. These will be in the BSAVA formulary. You can check that and check the actual dose rates that you need to use. Thiamine can also be administered along with other B vitamins as various forms of injections. And when you have started feeding these patients, you need to monitor these parameters daily. So on at least a once daily basis, you will be checking electrolytes, phosphate, magnesium, and probably ionized calcium as well. And alongside that, packed cell volume and glucose, and measuring body weight to check that it's heading in the right direction. If you experience problems with refeeding syndrome and these parameters are abnormal, you will need to check your electrolytes much more frequently than that, perhaps every 4 to 6 hours while you supplement those individual parameters. So this is a very serious condition when it happens, can be fatal and is best avoided at all costs. So be very careful. Your immediate instinct in an animal that's as thin as that and as malnourished as that is to get food into it quickly. But in fact, that could make matters considerably worse. So take it easy with your feeding, go slow and steady, and build up gradually over a period of 5 to 7 days in animals with extended periods of anorexia. So I'm hoping that that has covered many of the questions you may have wondered about tube feeding in small animals. I hope I have encouraged you to utilize esophagostomy tubes in particular, because they really are very simple to place and extremely useful in general practice and can be used by the owner at home. Although I'm not a fan of nasoesophageal tubes, as you've noticed from previous slides, obviously they still have a place and some feeding is better than none. Malnutrition is something that's very common in small animal practice and something we only think about too far down the line. So even if the only facilities you have are to use NO tubes, that's better than nothing. But I encourage you, where possible, to consider the use of esophagostomy tubes or even PEG tubes. So just a question or two that I've seen has come through while we've been speaking. I'll just try and address that if I can. So the first question is, when do you decide to remove a feeding tube? Well, what we would do is, if an animal's had a feeding tube in place for any length of time, so maybe an O-tube or a PEG tube that's been in for several weeks, we want to start reducing the volume of food that we're providing the animal with via the tube and see if it will stimulate appetite. And if we're getting a positive response to that, then the animal's taking more and more food orally on a daily basis. At that stage, we can then not remove the tube, but stop using it altogether. We just leave it in place, flush it regularly with water to keep it patent, and see if the animal can reach its resting energy requirements through oral alimentation alone. If it can, great. At that stage, the tube can be removed. If it can't, then we can start using the tube again. One of the other questions that come up is, can an animal still eat well it has a feeding tube in place? And the answer is absolutely yes, and that's encouraged. So even though we're using a feeding tube, we don't necessarily stop offering food, and that can be left with the patient to encourage them to return to more normal form of alimentation and to allow us to see whether the underlying disease process is resolving and the animal starting to feel better. And the last question I've got coming through here is there any specific diet which is less likely to cause refeeding syndrome? Good question. No, to be honest, it's kind of more dependent on the number of calories you're providing and the speed at which they're being delivered rather than the actual diet itself. But there is perhaps some evidence from human medicine that it might be slightly better to avoid a very high proportion of calories coming from carbohydrates in the first instance. So a diet that may be a little bit more fat or protein heavy, where appropriate, may be less likely to cause refeeding syndrome than a diet that's got a very high carbohydrate content. So thank you everyone for listening, and I'm going to pass you back to Emer now.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Yvonne for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.